Hey, Curie listeners. A quick reminder to check out our website, curie.md. You'll find all of our podcast episodes there, plus daily word games designed to challenge healthcare professionals, as well as Curie Briefs, our up-to-date, high-signal news summaries that cut through the noise. That's curie.md, your home for smarter, sharper clinical content. And now, on to the podcast. Picture this. It's your very first day as a surgical resident at one of New York's busiest hospitals. You spent years grinding through pre-med, med school, and training, and you're finally here. But in the middle of that first shift, you get a call. Your brother has been in a diving accident. He's broken his neck, and he's now quadriplegic. That's where Dr. Aaron Nance's story begins, on both sides of the hospital curtain, as a clinician and as a family member watching the system from the inside. In the years since, Dr. Nance has become one of the country's most visible physician advocates, telling these kinds of stories to millions on TikTok, unpacking the seven stages of misdiagnosis in her best-selling memoir, Little Misdiagnosed, and launching Feel Better, a new digital health platform built to connect credible experts with patients who need answers. She's also the host of the Medical Detectives podcast, where she turns real-life medical mysteries into gripping human dramas. Today on the show, we talked to Dr. Aaron Nance about the viral moment that started her advocacy, why she thinks the medical profession needs more North Star believers, and what she's learned about changing healthcare from the exam room to the comment section. Dr. Aaron Nance, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Andrew, for having me.
I'm very excited to be speaking with you today because, and I mean this as a very genuine compliment, I feel like your name is everywhere right now. Best-selling author, digital health entrepreneur, social media celebrity, all in addition, of course, to being a orthopedic surgeon. And so that's a lot of different hats that you wear, and I'm very excited to dig into all of them eventually. But I want to start with something more recent. In the last month, you've published a memoir titled Little Misdiagnosed. And so my first question for you is, what was the catalyst for writing the book? Was there a particular moment or maybe, you know, a straw that broke the camel's back that convinced you and you said, hey, I have to write this down. The world needs to hear these stories. What was the catalyst behind writing the book?
Well, I always feel like everyone has one Netflix-worthy story about their life. And for me, that story has always been my first day of work. And on that first day, as an orthopedic surgery resident at Lenox Hill Hospital, my brother was in a diving accident out in the Hamptons. He broke his neck and became a quadriplegic. And it really kind of set the scene for how I became a doctor, starting my journey on the other side of the curtain, right? Being that family member of someone who was injured in such a catastrophic way. And when I told that story on social media, I mean, it was viewed, I think, over 3 million times, right? It just really, really resonated with people, you know, because it's more about just, you know, an injury and myself. It's about what happens when life throws you a curveball. Right. I had planned my whole life. I was waiting my whole life. I had done all of the, you know, the volunteering, the pre-med work, the studying, the tests, the board exams. And then I finally get to what I want to do. And all of a sudden, a bomb just, you know, goes off in my lap. So I think that's how, you know, that story was almost, you know, instant viral. And so then I started telling other stories about my time in residency, and they were also instantly viral. And again, I think it was not so much because of the specific, you know, diagnosis or the specific case, but about how I was always going the extra mile to be that advocate for my patient, whether it was me, you know, lying about their name to get them in under a John Doe so they could have surgery safely, or me cursing out an attending because he wasn't showing up on call to take care of an emergency case. It's really like a sneak peek behind the curtain as to the moral gray zones that physicians are placed in every day.
Yeah, the title Little Misdiagnosis, a playful double meaning, but I think it's also, you know, a very powerful metaphor for what so many patients have unfortunately experienced as, you know, as they navigate this very complex healthcare process. And I always think about this patient-doctor interaction kind of as this very like subtle dance where you have patients that want answers and doctors obviously want to provide them. And so doctors will tend to ascribe names and labels because those names and labels can feel like incremental progress, like you're making progress and momentum towards some type of end result. But I also feel like these names and labels, while they can feel like progress, can also become a trap. So I wanted to ask, what does little misdiagnose mean to you? And why do you think it's so important to name or bring awareness to this phenomenon, especially now?
Well, interestingly enough, I started my channel Little Misdiagnosed because I solved someone's medical mystery, a 10-year medical mystery, in 3 seconds. But I didn't solve it in my office. I solved it over TikTok. And I started a brand new channel, Little Misdiagnosed, and I told that story. And again, that story went instant viral, not because people could relate to having a glomus tumor that was misdiagnosed, but because they felt, oh my gosh, my doctor isn't listening to me. I've seen 5 doctors and no one can give me answers. I feel like no one's really taking my pain seriously, right? And these were all of these sentiments that when one of the major issues with medicine, right, is things are so siloed, right? You have your experts and they're really an expert just on glomus tumors, you know, per se. Whereas there are so many universal themes to just being sick that really pull us together. But no one had kind of grouped people in one group as being a misdiagnosed group, right? Mm-hmm. So you can be diagnosed with cancer, but you probably had signs and symptoms of cancer for a long time that were probably misdiagnosed, right? Or just undiagnosed for a long period of time. You could have an autoimmune disorder that for years had been misdiagnosed or undiagnosed. And that was really, I discovered this underbelly of unrest of patients who were sick and tired of not getting the answers that they need. And what I talk about a lot, I talk about this on my podcast a lot, I mentioned this in my TED talk, but diagnosis is power. And what I mean by that is, for us to move forward as physicians, we have to have an ICD-10 code, right, in order for a treatment to be approved. So having that diagnosis, that ICD-10 code, that enables you to get treatment, right? That can give you a prognosis. But what you're talking about is something that I also mention, is that sometimes a diagnosis is just a description, right? And it's actually not leading towards a treatment plan. It's not leading towards a prognosis. And it's something that it's just, as you kind of described it, to give the patient something to think that they've been making progress. But in the end, if you're just told that you have irritable bowel syndrome, that doesn't help you at all. There is no cause related with that problem. So for someone just to come up with a label that then doesn't have necessarily a clear path to a resolution is not helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, earlier you mentioned your TED Talk, and I know that one of the major themes in that TED Talk was this framework or this concept around the 7 stages of misdiagnosis, very similar, almost a parallel to the 7 stages of grief. Can you shed some more light on this framework, and what do you see as the most common traps that patients fall into when they go through those seven stages of misdiagnosis?
Well, I've had well over 100,000 comments on all of my misdiagnosis videos, and I host the Medical Detectives podcast for almost a year now. And I just kept noticing this same pattern of what people would go through when they went through a misdiagnosis. And I mentioned in the talk, it is very similar to those stages of grief, which people are more familiar with. But I wanted people to understand that it's normal to feel doubt. It's normal to feel anger. It's normal to feel depressed. It's normal to feel anxious. These are all stages that happen during the journey of getting a misdiagnosis. And then often it cycles around, right? You think, oh, thank God, I'm finally seeing the specialist. I've waited 6 months to see this specialist. You get anxious over, you know, oh, I really hope that they find that they do the test and whatnot. And then when your labs come back normal and they say there's nothing wrong with you, then you start doubting yourself. Like, maybe I am making this up. Maybe I am crazy, right? But then the symptoms don't go away. And then you're angry because you go, there is something wrong with me. And just no one is able to figure it out. So I saw these people just get stuck in this cycle of stages. And some of the, you know, the ways that I have found to help people either shortcut those stages or get out of the cycle. Number one is having those North Star believers. And these are people who, they may be a doctor, they may be a family member, they may be a friend, they may be someone in a support group online who you've never met before. But these are people who believe you, right? They believe that when you say something is wrong, that something is wrong. And they may not necessarily be the ones to come up with the treatment strategy or the diagnosis, but they are going to not let you give up on yourself and not go into those final stages of depression and apathy. So finding those North Star believers, as I said, if you have a doctor, maybe you're lucky and it's your primary care doctor, who they're going to be the one to say, hey, I don't know what's going on, but this is someone who I think could have more information. Let's send you over to them, right? And it feels more like you're on this path together, not being pushed off to someone else so they can get them off your hands, right? Mm-hmm. And so these are those North Star physicians, North Star family members, North Star friends that are so important to helping you get a diagnosis. Mm.
For our listeners, what is the best way to identify or to enlist or enroll to find someone that could serve as that North Star believer for you?
I think a lot of it is first just feeling what the vibe and the fit is with your physician, right? It's a little bit like dating. Sometimes you click and sometimes you don't. And I say this message over and over, but the eye only sees what the mind knows. So if you meet with a doctor and they don't know what's wrong with you within the first 5 minutes, they're probably not going to be able to help you get your answer, right? Mm-hmm. But if you have someone who does not know what is wrong with you, but there is still that spark of curiosity, right? They continue to ask you more questions. They keep trying to offer new solutions for you. Those are the doctors that you want to hold on to.
Yeah, I want to pivot to another motif within the book around gender bias and breaking barriers, specifically within orthopedics, because there is a mind-boggling statistic that really caught my eye when I saw it, and it goes that women make up less than 15% of all orthopedic residents in the United States, and that's been the case for several generations now. You've obviously navigated this space as a woman and as a surgeon and as an advocate for others. And so I wanted to ask, you know, was there a particular moment that you ran headfirst into the wall and where you thought, wow, this system is really convoluted. It's maybe not necessarily built for people like me. And how did you respond to that moment? How did you turn that into rocket fuel to help propel you forward?
Well, it's funny because I told you earlier that I am moving apartments, and so I'm going through all my boxes, going through all the old photos and everything. And I had these photos from when I was a 6, 7 year old, you know, 8 year old, my soccer teams. And I was always the only girl on the boys' soccer team. And so I said, I've always been that girl. Okay. It's literally been in my DNA. I grew up with three brothers. You know, my mom's Division I athlete, huge, you know, tomboy. So for me, that was nothing new to break into a field that is primarily male. And when we talk about full numbers, the number is actually only 6% of physicians. So that means practicing physicians. Over the years, we have made some gains in residents. So there are more female residents. But the problem is, they can't stay in the field. They don't stay in the field because the field is completely, you know, designed against us primarily. It's almost impossible to have a family, you know, while you're training. And then female orthopedic surgeons are, I believe the statistics are 3 times more likely to have breast cancer than the general population, and twice more likely to experience infertility than the general female population. So we are physically giving up our bodies, our health, our future at having a family to be in this profession. And for the longest time, those numbers, what I really focused on was how hard it is for women to become orthopedic surgeons, right? If 94% of the field is men. And it's only recently that I have reframed those statistics to think there are only 6% of this field who is looking out for over 50% of the population. And it's actually the population of female that has suffered because this field has been so male dominated. And just to give you an example, when I was a fellow at Hospital for Special Surgery, we had to complete a research study, right? And that was a requirement for the end of the year. It was a research topic of our choice, and then we were presented at the end. Everyone is talking, you know, they're talking about their sports injuries, their, you know, Tommy John surgery for pitchers, they're doing things about, you know, fractures and skateboarders or whatnot. And I wanted to research wrist pain in yoga. And the feedback that I got was, well, that's not a problem. Or, who cares about that? Why does that matter? And I had to fight to get that research, to perform that research and publish that research. And that was the first research ever done in hand surgery about dedicated to wrist pain in yoga. Something that millions of people do. When if you look up the amount of Tommy John surgery research papers, which literally only affects a couple hundred professional pitchers and some college, you know, pitchers, all right, there are research numbers in the tens of thousands. So these are the disparities that you may not, they may not seem evident, but then when you ask, oh, why is it that women are more likely to experience fractures when they're older as opposed to men? Right? Why is it almost 2 times as likely that women will experience a fracture? Right? Who are the people who break their wrists, who break their hips? It's grandma. Okay? Yes, you know, anyone can break a bone, but it disproportionately affects women. And it's because we haven't put in the research to understand how the decreasing level of estrogen after menopause affects bone health. And only now do we really understand the protective effect of estrogen. And so we should be thinking, how can we educate more people on how we can protect and prevent these fractures instead of us spending all of our time just fixing all of these fractures?
One thing that I like and what I appreciate about your book is that it doesn't shy away from, I think, challenging some of these traditional conventional thoughts or even the traditional hierarchy of medicine or, you know, even trying to bend some of the rules if that's what the patient needs. And you kind of spoke to that a little bit earlier. And there's other stories that I'm sure, and I'll let you expound on. But my question, and I'm curious to hear, what kind of feedback have you gotten from your colleagues or just in general from the medical establishment about your book and about some of these challenges and about some of this rule bending? You know, do people see this as risky? Do people see this as necessary? And maybe some people even see it as maybe you need a little bit of both.
You know, I got a very surprised text message from one of the heads of the internal medicine department, who is now, I believe, retired. And it was a text that said, "Don't know how I got this number, but it's Dr. Orscher. I just want to let you know, I read your book. It was incredible. What an accomplishment. Keep doing what you're doing." And it was so wonderful for him just to reach out to me, right? Because in essence, I am calling out a lot of the problems that exist and, you know, taking a peek behind the curtain, and it's not pretty. And part of the reason why I shared these stories is because people should know that as residents, we are learning from our examples, our mentors, in good ways and in bad ways. Mm-hmm. And it's only until we speak out about these things and even acknowledge that they exist that there can be change. One of the stories I told about was, you know, my residency lounge. And again, it's a male-dominated lounge. And so there's swimsuit calendars on the wall, and there are maxi pads on the wall, and there are cardboard cutouts of dicks on the wall. And it wasn't until I became chief resident, where I felt I even had some level of power and authority, I said, all the dicks are coming down. All right, this is not acceptable. And all this time, right, I spoke about how I was that girl. Part of the reason why I had some trepidation about writing these stories is because I loved my residency. I excelled in my training. I matched at the top places. I had top grades. I absolutely loved it. And part of that was because I was really good at assimilating with what would make me do really well in these rotations and going along with the jokes. And I found the jokes funny myself. But in reflection, I realized by me not speaking up, I was making it that much harder for someone else to speak up about it. And so that is really why I said, you know what, I have to get these stories out there, at least to open up the conversation and to try and make things easier for the next generation of female orthopedic surgeons.
That was fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. I want to transition actually over to the topic of storytelling, and to use that as a segue to introduce your new digital health platform called Feel Better. But before we get there, I understand, obviously, you have a social media page by the same name as the book. And, you know, we're talking over 750,000 followers on TikTok. And so you've really built a massive community that is, you know, highly networked and highly connected. And so, you know, in the process of building this audience and building this following and building this network, I wanted to ask, what have you learned about the power of storytelling and the power of using storytelling and narrative to change the broader healthcare conversation?
I believe that storytelling is the best way to get information across. And when people started questioning me why I was on TikTok, like, isn't that the place with the dancing kids and the funny dog videos? And I had to tell them that, yes, there are a lot of really funny dog videos and dancing kids, but it is really an information sharing platform. Mm-hmm. And to me, the most engaging way to share information is through storytelling. And that was the first, I would say, you know, 6 months of my channel was strictly storytelling. I only told my own stories from my residency. And then I was being bombarded, and I'm talking about over 1,000 either emails, direct messages, comments of people asking me to share their story so that one person wouldn't feel alone, or if it could help one person get to their diagnosis sooner. And then that's when I switched to more of my disease awareness campaigns. I really broke out with my first 31 for 31 most commonly misdiagnosed conditions in women series. That was 2 years ago. I've since done two more series, and I'm currently in the middle of a series right now in August. And what I do is I start off the content with pretty much a personal story from someone who was written into me. And I am speaking about it as if I'm experiencing this condition or have this condition. And then, and that's what captures people's attention, right? That's what people's emotion clings onto, because they're like, I feel that same way too. Or yeah, no one believes me about this also. And then I use that attention to then do the education, right? Then I go into, these are some like really simple facts about what this is. And then I always end my content with a call to action to allow other people to share their experience and their stories in the comments. Because this is just tips and tricks for anyone who's listening, who's interested in going viral and having, you know, gaining followers and having, you know, lots of views. And Mr. Beast actually says this, you know, he all the time goes, people ask me, how can I get more views? And he says, the question you should be asking is, how can I make the best video I can make? And for me, that means making a video that makes someone care about something that they did not even care about before they watched that video. And so I think that storytelling is that way to get people to care about it.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a great transition point over to Feel Better. In the last month, you've published a memoir, but you've also launched a new digital health platform. I think most people would be lucky to just do one of those in a career, much less the same summer. So congrats to you. But from what I understand, Feel Better is a social platform for digital health support. And you've said it's based on the idea that people are the best medicine. And so my first question about Feel Better here is, what was kind of the original spark behind wanting to start the Feel Better platform?
So what I recognized was that when I would post a video, let's say I posted a video about endometriosis. Mm-hmm. I'm a hand surgeon, all right? I'm not even the most qualified person to be speaking about endometriosis. But as a physician, I still carry enough, you know, authority and education to talk, you know, credibly about different health conditions. But the reason why these videos, right, that endometriosis video probably was viewed 2 million times. The reason why the video goes viral has very little to do with me. It has everything to do with the people in the comments. All right. Mm-hmm. If you analyze all of my videos, there are more likes for the comments than for the original content. And what I learned is that people were communicating with another and helping one another and sharing information through the comments. I was just the vessel for everyone else to have this kind of safe and trusted place to have these conversations. Because in my mind, you need both the physician expertise and the people with the lived experience for people to get a full picture of what support looks like. So that was the original reason to build Feel Better, is because I wanted to create these safe and trusted places for people, number one, to get credible health information. And that is really the differentiating factor between Feel Better and TikTok. Feel Better is more like television, right? Not everybody gets to be on TV. And this is where the credibility layer comes in. You have to be a licensed physician. You have to be a vetted researcher. You have to, you know, be a vetted, you know, brand who's innovating in the space. We want the content to come from these credible sources, but then we also want to create the space where people can share their own experiences. And it's not necessarily about giving medical advice, but it's about allowing people to accumulate different points of view that will then empower them to have better conversations with their doctor. So that is the end goal, is to just provide a curated and customized feed and experience for the user based on their symptoms and their conditions, so that mm-hmm. they can get both credible information from experts, but also information that they're not going to hear from their doctor's office, right? Some of these, the best information is from the people with lived experience. So we wanted to create this space so that both people could get the value of both of those points of view. Right now, we're really focused on bringing on those trusted medical voices onto the platform. And that's why we're working with different physicians, we're working with different health systems, we're working with different research groups. We just signed on the Norris Lab, which is, this is incredible. This is an entire lab run out of the Medical University of South Carolina studying Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a connective tissue disorder, and every single researcher has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Okay, they kill it already on Instagram and TikTok. But the reason why they're working with us is because those platforms were never created specifically for sharing health information online. And so we built this platform not only to be a safe and trusted place for the users, mm-hmm. but also as a safe and trusted place for the experts, right? It is really hard to put a lot of effort into educational content and then have all of these trolls, right, and people attack you for trying to educate people. Right. And I believe that if you create something where it is a dedicated space for health, right, this is not some platform where you're just like, oh, let me pass the time and be entertained, right? This is, you know what, I'm worried I may have long COVID. I don't know where I can get real credible information. Let me go to Feel Better.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a little bit more about the user experience and the user experience for a physician as well as a patient? So let's just say, you know, I am like a diabetes patient. I log on to Feel Better. What does my user experience look like? Do I post some information about my particular case and then physicians can comment on it? Or how does that process work?
So the platform looks, feels, smells like social media. So it has a automated feed. And that feed is generated based on you do some onboarding of your symptoms, your conditions, if you have a diagnosis, or your health interests. So if you have a history of diabetes and you may say, I have foot ulcers, all right, you're going to hear, or on your feed, you're going to be fed videos from endocrinologists who are speaking about diabetes. You're going to be hearing from researchers who are actively researching on diabetes. You're going to be hearing from different diabetes foundations who are talking about the latest support groups and things and patient stories about diabetes. So it works for patients if you know you have a condition. What I really think the ultimate value is if you don't know what condition you have and you only have symptoms. So what we have done on the back end is built a algorithm that has over 2,200 disease conditions and over 100,000 symptom data points. So if you say that I have fatigue, I have headaches, I have, you know, double vision, you may not know that you have idiopathic intracranial hypertension, but all of those symptoms on our back end, we're going to show you content so that when you go to your doctor, you say, you can recognize the pattern and say, huh, I've been having X, Y, and Z. Do you think I could have idiopathic intracranial hypertension? And why I'm using this diagnosis specifically is to go back to that statement I said about the eyes only see what the mind knows. Because if you went to your doctor and your doctor did not know what idiopathic intracranial hypertension is, you're never going to get diagnosed with IIH. So I hope for the user, it will be a place where perhaps it's going to help decrease time to getting a diagnosis. It's a place where they're going to meet other people in the comments who are struggling with the same thing. Because again, that content was curated just for them. So you're going to be seeing the same content as other people who have the same symptoms and the same conditions. And then from a creator perspective, a user, a creator, you know, account, what I really built this for is a place for them to build their authority and expertise to a very targeted audience, right? Because there is nothing more frustrating. Let's say that I am a neurologist that specializes in intracranial hypertension. If I make a video and I post it on Instagram, maybe 200 people see it, right? That's kind of defeating. Whereas if you post that same video to feel better, you're going to be able to see that 200 people with intracranial hypertension viewed your video. Mm-hmm. And so it allows you to really understand the impact that these videos are having. And for most, you know, brands, right, they're all trying to reach a targeted audience. And so what Feel Better is doing on the back end is through our, that's what our algorithm is through our curation, is to deliver that audience. And the, I would say the end goal is to deliver the right information to the right person at the right time.
Yeah. Kind of connecting the experts to the people that need to hear their insights the most. I wanted to zoom out a little bit and actually talk about kind of the longer term vision for Feel Better. Because, you know, I obviously see it as a space for patient empowerment, but I was curious how you think about the way in which the platform can be positioned, even with, you know, with respect to how we deliver care and how we might educate or inform or even train doctors. How do you envision Feel Better kind of fitting within the broader algorithm or the broader treatment paradigm of how we deliver healthcare?
I would liken it to about 15 years ago, right? Every doctor was told you have to have a website, right? Doctors didn't have websites over 15 years ago. And similarly, nowadays they're told you have to be on social media. You have to have a social media presence. And I understand the discomfort with being on a platform that actively elevates medical misinformation over credible, accurate information. I wouldn't want to waste my time on a platform like that either. And I know many health systems, for them, that's a liability, right? So this is really where I see the future of Feel Better. Whereas up until now, having clinicians on social media has always been seen as a liability. Where I think we need to be recognizing that these are the hidden gems, okay? Your most powerful advertisements for your health system and your office are your physicians. They are the sources of medical truth. But because we haven't been on social media, we have lost that race. Okay. And we've lost it to wellness influencers. We've lost it to people who are spreading medical misinformation. And not only have we lost the race, but that system is rigged against us. All right. Again, they reward people who create content that creates division, right? That creates all this, you know, chatter back and forth. Mm-hmm. On Feel Better, how we measure success of a video has nothing to do with the number of views, with the number of likes, with the amount of watch time, okay? How we measure success is how well did we match the content that a creator made to the interests of the particular user. And in that way, we really feel like that's medicine at its core, right? The word doctor comes from the word docere, which means to teach. And I think this is really going back to basics. This is what doctors got into being a doctor for in the first place, right? To actually help people. And I think it starts with the education.
Dr. Nance, this has been an incredible and insightful, educational, informative conversation. Just to kind of close this out here, what is the most important takeaway or call to action that you hope our listeners glean from this conversation?
You know, I hope listeners really understand that There is no one who cares more about your health than you. And to find either advocates or tools that are going to help you become the CEO of your own health. And what I'm doing with Feel Better, what I'm doing through my podcast, what I'm doing through my, you know, social media, they're just different ways at helping you believe yourself, right? To trust yourself if something is wrong, and to really empower you to have those best conversations and interactions with your doctor so you can stay as healthy as you possibly can.
Dr. Nance, thank you so much for sharing your story, for sharing your vision. For anyone who wants to follow you, follow your work, follow Feel Better, pick up the book, where should they go?
There's too many things to point out, but I will say the only original content that I make online is on TikTok, on sure. Little Misdiagnosed. I cannot tell you the amount of people who write to me saying they saw me on Facebook or YouTube or Instagram, and it's probably an imposter account and not me. But that is where all my original content is. For people who love books, Little Misdiagnosed is everywhere you can find books. People who love podcasts, The Medical Detectives it's an absolutely incredible podcast if you like Dateline meets Grey's Anatomy. And then for Feel Better, this is just kind of a sneak peek for your listeners. It has not launched publicly yet, but I, you know, love early feedback. And so if any of your listeners are interested in taking the app for a spin, it's Feel Better, B-E-T-R. Feel Better, B-E-T-R. It's live on the App Store and would love any. Listen, people can message me on LinkedIn. That's probably where I'll see a direct message, you know, the best. But I'm really here. I would say the second half of my career is really devoted to patient advocacy. You know, I probably spent the first 20 years in patient care. And now I still do patient care, but I think I have found an even greater calling, which is being that patient voice as a doctor.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Nance, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you, Andrew, for having me.